Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. Learn more at nm.org/better.
On WGN, John Hanson in for John Williams. And on the other line is Dr. Jeffrey Copen, Chief Medical Officer, Northwestern Medicine, Lake Forest Hospital. Dr. Copen, hello. Thanks for joining us, as always.
Hey, John. How are you? Long time no talk.
Yeah, it has been a little bit. Thrilled to have you here. Of course, sponsored by Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. I wanted to start with this study that I read that AFib is way more prevalent in the national scene than we realize. Previous studies have reported that about 3 million people in the U.S. have AFib, and now that might be three times as much. Now, I haven't dug deep into it as if more people are getting it, or perhaps what is probably more likely is we're just learning a lot more about it, able to spot it, so more people are being diagnosed with it. What's your take on this? Because this is a big story.
It is a big story, and AFib is a significant health issue in the United States. So first of all, AFib is short for atrial fibrillation. It's a relatively common heart arrhythmia, which means that the heart's electrical activity is erratic, and that normal bump-bump-bump-bump-bump that we all associate with the way our hearts beat, that's not happening. Atrial fibrillation can be a real problem for people. Everything from increasing stroke risk to prompting heart failure. So it's not the kind of thing you really want to have. And if you do have it, you want to make sure it gets treated.
Yeah.
It can be treated in multiple different ways. But I think this issue that you bring up, though, John, of prevalence, how common is it in the population? I'm not surprised that there are studies now that are showing it's more prevalent than what we thought. We have better ways of making the diagnosis because in many people, atrial fibrillation isn't there all the time. It literally comes and goes. It can be quite fleeting. So we now have diagnostic tools that allow us to pick that up. And I think that's gone a long way. And, you know, another thing, John, and even in my own practice, I've seen this, people who have these new electronic watches that they wear,
yep,
you know, just, you know, like an Apple Watch or these Garmin devices, they all have sensors that can pick up atrial fibrillation. So that's been helpful, too, in making the diagnosis.
I imagine also, and in my dad's case, Dr. Copen, I don't know if I've told you before, but he had a stroke. He was the fire chief of Lincolnwood in his last couple of weeks, I believe, or days, and he had a stroke in front of his paramedics. Thank God, because he was then immediately, they recognized what was going on. He ended up surviving. We have really improved our stroke awareness and symptoms of it, and hopefully the response times for more positive outcomes. And then later on, he was able to determine that he had AFib. That's what it was that triggered it. Just simply more people surviving strokes probably reveals more people in the population with AFib.
Yeah. AFib is, as I stated, a common cause of stroke. Turns out that the way that this arrhythmia affects the upper chambers of the heart, the atria, that can cause blood clots to form in the left atrium, and that one of those little pieces of clot can break off and can get into the circulation and cause a stroke. But, well, John, what a story with your dad.
I know.
It's in front of his paramedics. Incredible.
Yeah, and my dad, not to brag on my dad, but he was one of the people that helped redesign the stroke response plan for Northeast Illinois. And one of the paramedics thought maybe he was joking or trying to test because he didn't quite know what was happening to him. He thought he was leading the meeting, and it kind of felt a little odd, but it was everyone else who noticed the drooping face and his slurring words, and they said, "Well, Chief, you're having a stroke." And they cleared the way, and thank God they did. They got the CT scan immediately, and they were able to give him the clot buster after that when they determined it wasn't a bleed. And if he had been maybe 2 weeks later doing yard work at home alone after retirement, it would have been a different outcome. But,
goosebumps
telling that story.
That's perfect stroke care that he received. That's really extraordinary, right? Because we want to make sure those people who have the kind of strokes that we can intervene, be it with one of the clot buster drugs that we use, yep, or one of the other interventions, time is of the essence. So I can't imagine anybody who could be treated for a stroke much more quickly.
No, in a better situation,
right? Dad was.
Unless you're in the hospital about to get a CT scan, you couldn't do it any faster. So we appreciate that. And he had an ablation, which was the science is amazing, Dr. Copen, how they're able to, and I love how I'm explaining ablations to a doctor. They are able to stick essentially a catheter up his wrist, up to his heart, to kind of zap the heart in a way that fixed the problem, at least to a certain extent.
Yeah, yeah. The cardiologists who do that, they're called electrophysiologists. They literally are the electricians of the heart. They're extraordinary what they're able to do. They can identify where the erratic impulse is coming from that's causing atrial fibrillation, and using various types of interventions through that catheter, they can actually ablate or destroy the erratic electrical impulse that's causing atrial fibrillation.
It's crazy.
It really is amazing.
Yeah, we live in the future. It's insane. 217, would a stress test on a treadmill tell if you have AFib? Because like you said, Dr. Copen, some people, it happens once in a blue moon.
Yeah, doing stress tests is not a diagnostic test for atrial fibrillation. Now, if somebody didn't know he or she had atrial fibrillation and they were getting ready, being prepared by the technician to have a stress test, the electrocardiogram would show atrial fibrillation if the patient was in atrial fibrillation. There are people who go into atrial fibrillation when they're on a stress test, but that's really a different subject that we don't want to talk about right now.
Mm-hmm.
But no, if you having a stress test that does not show atrial fibrillation does not necessarily mean that patient never has atrial fibrillation.
So maybe it's if you notice your heart racing at times, maybe you're faint sometimes or you're lightheaded, could be a reason to talk to your doctor about stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, there's other things, too. Like, one of the things, Jen, we talk a lot about is sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is an emerging science. Frankly, when I was a medical student back in the 1980s, I don't think we even knew there was such a thing, right? Yeah. Now, it's a commonly diagnosed issue. And people who have sleep apnea, particularly undiagnosed, untreated sleep apnea, are at higher risk for atrial fibrillation. Interesting, isn't it?
Is it genetic or is it lifestyle choices or we don't know yet?
How about all of the above?
Okay.
It's one of the, I don't think there's any question that there's, in certain people, not everyone, in certain people, there is a genetic predisposition to the development of that erratic electrical tissue that can lead to atrial fibrillation. But other people, if you're obese, that could be a risk factor. If you have sleep apnea, either with obesity or not, that can be a risk factor. And then the biggest one of all is hypertension, high blood pressure.
Yep.
So,
when I went to the doctor for my physical, I talked about my dad's history. He said, let's slap an EKG on you just to take a look. Obviously, you had to catch it in the moment. Everything looks fine. But I definitely got the warning of like, hey, if this ever happens later in life, lightheaded, all these other things, take a look at it. Really quickly, I know we got to take a break. We'll have a little bit more. Someone wanted to know, I think I know what the answer is, but any link from COVID vaccines to AFib?
No.
Okay. That was a quick answer. But, you know, people wonder and people hear things and they might associate those things as causation that aren't from friends or family. But I want
to. Yeah, no, it's good. Please, and, you know, and dear listeners, ask these questions. Let's talk about it. There's nothing you can't ask. And if we don't have the answer, I'll let you know that too.
I love that. All right, Dr. Copen, I see this headline. Study: breathing might bring microplastics into the brain. And that signals my end of worrying about microplastics, because what am I going to do? Like, why? This is very defeatist.
John, who writes headlines like that? You know, my only comment is, what would we do without headline writers and studies?
Yeah, what is this about?
Yeah, so microplastics is a really hot subject in our water and air. What may it be doing to our health? We don't know. This is a subject that's out there. No one should panic about this. All this study was is somebody looked at the olfactory bulb, which is how we smell. This is way up in our nose. and little particles that we inhale when we breathe get up there, and that's how we have our sense of smell. It's an incredible system, incredibly elegant, you know, just genius of our human biology. It's possible for small particles, and we're talking microscopic size, to actually pass through the olfactory bulb into the brain. And what the study showed is they could identify some microplastic in brains on autopsy, and they are hypothesizing that it came in through the olfactory bulb. That's all they know. The study authors were very, very careful to say we have no idea whether this is a health problem or not. All we're saying is we identified the microplastics.
Yeah, so. But that's not exciting enough, Dr. Copen. So breathing might bring microplastics into brain. Let's go with
so
that.
So, John, if one of our listeners can figure out how to get by without breathing, let us know. Share the information.
And that's how you get a job as the chief medical officer at Northwestern Medicine Lake Forest Hospital. A couple texts about the COVID vaccine. A couple had COVID in August, and they're wondering when they can get the vaccine again. Can you just kind of give us a minute of where we are with COVID, any new vaccine news, what to worry about or not?
Yeah, so quick update. As we all know from our own experience, a lot of COVID still around. A lot. People are getting it, right? I'm probably every week, all our listeners either got it themselves or know someone who has gotten it. So it's around and it's not going away. So it's going to be here. Think about it as a bad flu. There are still people dying from it. And as I always say, those of us who are at risk, meaning we're older, we have chronic diseases, we're immunocompromised, people like that are at the highest risk. So you want to make sure you get your COVID vaccine. The new COVID vaccines are available at the pharmacies. Some of the doctors' clinics are beginning to receive their supply. This is a really good time to get the COVID vaccine, particularly if you fall into those high-risk categories. And even if you don't, I would still recommend that you get it. It will keep you from getting sick, really sick, if you get infected with the virus. And I'm happy to share with our listeners that last Wednesday evening, I went and got my own COVID vaccine. So I'm going to be good to go for, getting into the fall and winter months.
Is this going to be the first fall we finally get maybe the COVID and the flu vaccine in the same syringe, or is it still going to be a one in one arm, one in the other?
Yeah, we're a one in one still, okay. John. They're hoping for next year that it could be in one syringe. I would also recommend if you're somebody, let's say you decide you're going to go this week for your COVID shot, which is good, please do that. And I know there's plenty of vaccine around, so please go get it. If you know you can depend on yourself and you can wait a bit, wait about a month, if not a little bit longer, to get the flu shot. It's a little early to get the flu shot the way that the flu season, I think, is going to work this year. However, if you're going to forget, if you go get the COVID shot now and you say, I'll wait to get the flu, but you realize you're not that responsible to go back a second time.
I hear you.
It's okay to get the flu shot.
Just know yourself. If one trip makes sense, get them both. If you know that you're someone that's responsible, you can wait a little longer for the second one. That makes sense
to me. Exactly.
I'll be the test patient if they want to put both in the same syringe and fire away and see what happens. But maybe I'll volunteer myself another day. Dr. Copen, we appreciate your time. As always, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John. Everybody take good care. Bye-bye.
We will. Thank you very much.